is Meg Van Dusen.
For about the past two and a half years, I've been working for Coon Rock Farm, who leases land out here, and I'm the livestock manager for the farm and help manage this property. So, yeah.
Great. Well, right now we are watering the cows. So, I don't know, what's easier for you? We can just finish watering if you want instead and head back. How long does the watering take?
It'll take another like 10 minutes.
Okay, yeah, no, that's perfect.
Okay.
I kind of just want to.
Yeah, you're more than welcome.
Great.
I'll just pause it for a sec.
That's easier than wander.
These guys, there's no water supply. I don't know if you've read. I assume you've read like Omnivore's Dilemma, Joel Salatin, and Stuart Virginia, and management intensive grazing. So I'm trying to give these guys as small of an area as possible, graze them real quick. Ideally less than 4 days, which is the grow back of grass.
Oh, wow.
So they graze it down intensively. They don't have time to be selective. I really love being out here with the gunshots.
Who's shooting?
I'm not entirely sure. It seems to be like a response. So we were sighting in a rifle a month ago for deer season, and there are no gunshots. Then halfway through, we started hearing responses.
Oh my goodness.
Is this a good day? So someone else was sighting in there, so it was fun. So I'm going to pull up and back up to this
spot. Yeah, sure.
Welcome, Mark. If you want to see, if you can walk down this fence line a little bit.
Yeah.
You can actually, this charger is. Anything to drink?
I'm good.
Water and orange juice, and I think that's about it.
I'm great, thank you though. I guess we can I pretty much just like to always start with your childhood a little bit about like what got you to where you are today.
Yeah.
In a sense.
So like I said, I was raised in Wichita, Kansas, which is the south central part of the state. For what it's worth, the largest city in Kansas. We got that going for us. But I was raised in the city. So it's a very urban environment, but my dad was always kind of, they lived there before Wichita got too big, so he was used to being out. I grew up with guns, with just kind of going out to the country, things like that. A vegetable garden kind of in the backyard, composting, things like that. And so I did a lot of sports and stuff, so I was outside kind of. Plenty happy with that. So in Wichita, which is like can get to like 105 or so in the summers, things like that, it wasn't a huge deal. And then like I would always go when I was younger, the first day of deer season with my dad, which was really just me freezing my butt off outside while we sat there, and as any 8-year-old would want to talk and move and stay warm. I think my dad regretted the decision every year, but I got out of school and it's a bonding experience, so it was fun. And I never really did much hunting after that. It's something where I did the IB program in the school. And so I actually think high school is a little bit harder than college in some respects, just in terms of the sheer mass of stuff to do. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I thought I wanted to do chemical engineering and work with renewable energy. It's like, hey, I was looking at schools, and it came down to UNC simply because of the Moorhead. Mm-hmm. And I got that and thought, well, I've got a chemistry program. Close enough, right? I'll go there. Everything else seemed great. So I came to Carolina and didn't know anyone. And I started as a chemistry major. I took environmental science something, 201, whatever it is now. And so that was kind of tied in a little bit more renewable energy and stuff. I was like, hey, I want to do this. I can double major. Awesome. And I think as it kind of came about, I just not really disillusioned, but I went that first summer to India where I worked on that kind of model farm. They did vermicompost, medicinal plants, like tree planting. So kind of working with my hands, being outside, kind of teaching by doing in some respects, was a lot better for me. Mm-hmm. And it was something growing up, I always worked better with my hands, things like that, such that when I got back, I was just kind of disillusioned. I was like, I don't go to class. I'll do chemistry class. It's really just not worthwhile to me. And that's the point of like, I won't go to class. I just kind of coasted, mm-hmm. which was probably not the best thing, but I don't know. Kind of coming from there, it was a very different experience, being from Wichita, coming halfway across the U.S., trying to, like, I was very happy with myself in high school. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, I think, come to college, and it's touted as this big thing, like, redefine yourself, like, discover who you are. Like, I hear it's kind of like, I kind of like who I am. Like, I don't really want to change. And so it was a weird kind of experience for me, starting mm-hmm. out like that. But it was cool. I'm glad I came here and glad I got all the experiences, especially here in North Carolina with, like, the local agriculture and everything that I came to learn more about. But, yeah, it's fun. I guess I glossed over a lot of childhood there. But yeah, it was something where, I guess, as you had said, you kind of grew up with food. And it was always just kind of standard that we ate as a family. Mm-hmm. And then as my sister graduated, my brother graduated, we still ate as a family. It shifted more because I'd do stuff to like 6 or 7 at night, and a typical Phillips family dinner could have been anywhere from 7:30 to 10:30 at night. So it was very standard in that sense of like my mom had her sets of things and stuff I didn't like, but it was very much we always ate at home. And I've just been used to that. So whether it was like packing my own lunch and stuff, like I never really identified with people like, yeah, we're going to Wendy's today or something like that at lunch, because I was a runner, and it was something where I had this idea that I had to eat everything specifically, which isn't true, mm-hmm. but I had that. So it was always like a very set thing, like peanut butter and jelly, fruits, like I went through a phase where I was like trying to track what I ate just in terms of how much I was running and how that all tied in. And I've since learned not how misguided that was, but how it's kind of missing the bigger picture. And so that's been something where I've been very cognizant of what goes in my body, but it was much more in like the USDA, I think it's USDA who does the food pyramid and everything like mm-hmm. that. And like how many bad fats and good fats. And so that's been a really kind of awakening experience working at a farm and seeing not how that's incorrect, but again, how that misses the big picture. So it's been interesting working at the farm simply because working with meat, my mom always bought stuff. I'd help her cook things, but she was the one who always bought stuff. Mm-hmm. So she would buy, whether it was chicken or ground pork, or they would cook steak out, or the worst was when they'd cook shrimp, because the last thing I want is jumbo shrimp in Wichita, Kansas. And so it was something where she always did it. So I never really worked with meat so much, except I was making a sandwich. Mm-hmm. So the idea here, it's been a completely different thing to see what local, sustainably raised, organically raised meat is, and not really have the contrast with factory meat, because I just never bought it. Mm. At UNC, I ate at the dining hall a lot. If I ate at home, it was not vegetarian, but it was like eggs for breakfast, or making my own lunch, or things that didn't really require a whole lot of boneless, skinless chicken breast, or things like that. So it's been a very strange, I think, food experience, kind of going from when I was younger to older and all that stuff. But I like where I'm at now.
Yeah. So you were talking about kind of, as you were starting to track calories in high school and that was missing the big picture. What do you see as the big picture now?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is, I think one part where I got it was, and I guess I should start with my sister. Is she someone who's very much like, I'm not in shape, I'm overweight, I need to go on a diet. And I just find that very misguided, because the way I look at it is I can eat anything that I want as long as there's that kind of subtraction on the other end. If mm-hmm. I'm outside working all day, if I'm doing it, like, you can really put anything into your body to some extent. There's really, obviously you're not just going to sit there and eat bacon fat all day long. Which is delicious, but it's something where I was missing the point of it's not so much about the quantity. So if you're getting 10 grams of fat or 35 grams of protein in this, or how you're replacing it, I never even then understood kind of protein drinks and things like that are just ah protein being put back into your body because you've worked out and it's building this. It never made sense to me then, but even now it's much more of, did you actually enjoy what you ate? Did you cover everything? I still kind of get in that mindset of you should have a starch or something, or, oh, we don't have this, when there's been plenty of dinners at the farm where they put on like just 4 bone-in sirloins that were mostly bone that we got back from the cow, so we couldn't sell them. We could, it's just someone doesn't really want to buy a bone.
Yeah.
Well, unless you've got a dog who's your best friend and will continue to be your best friend.
Especially if you buy your bones.
Well, exactly. And you'll have other stuff. You'll have like roasted turnips or a salad and things like that. And you kind of get to the meal and go, well, I didn't have rice. I didn't have potatoes. I didn't have a pasta. And I'm full and I'm happy and my body feels right. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is kind of the point, is just the fact that you can finish a meal and be happy. Like, I've been one of those people, I never understood how people go, oh, I just got so busy, I skipped lunch today. Like, I can't do that. Usually my first question after I eat something is like, what's for lunch? And Meredith hates me for that. She's like, we just finished. I'm like, okay, well, what's for dinner? We'll skip one ahead. You don't have to get lunch yet. So it's kind of missing that bigger picture, I think, of, are you satisfied with your eating, with what you're eating? And one, I mean, with so many political interests in there and the meat industry and pharmaceutical industry and things like that, in terms of what fats are good, what's bad. I mean, the idea that like avocados are good fat. Well, where are they coming? I mean, they're coming from California. Like, kind of eating what you're happy with, making it work for you, and kind of balancing it based on just how your body feels.
Mm-hmm.
If you wake up the next morning and you feel right, it's a completely different thing than, okay, well, I ate my 3 to 5 servings of vegetables, 2 to 3 servings of fruits, things like that. So I think that was something that I've come to better terms with. I've never viewed food as just fuel. Like, mm-hmm. I tried to look at it more, but I think even more so it's kind of, what am I happy eating?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very fortunate to have access to like grass-fed lamb, grass-fed beef, pasture-raised pork, things like that. But it's been a shift, and it's something that even now I look back on and go, oh God, I've been here for 6 months on this farm, and I managed to feed myself. I don't always know what I can't look back on the week and go, oh yeah, I had this, this, and this. And sometimes I kind of go, how did I get here? How did I actually manage to feed myself?
But, yeah.
It's as weird as it sounds, it's something where sometimes I don't fully internalize the process of, oh, well, we had lamb rib chops with grits and salad, or we did like sauteed kale and garlic and onions. And that was a horrible thing I did recently. I was like, oh, this will be great with kale and onions and garlic. I'll put it over rice and fried eggs. So yeah, not as great as I thought it would be.
Really?
Maybe it wasn't the right time for me to fully appreciate it, but it was a trial. And so I think I don't fully have the big picture now, but I think I understand more of, not to get bogged down in just numbers, which is very difficult for a chemistry major at sometimes.
That's cool. So like you said, you've been feeding yourself here. What do you often find yourself, you know, how do you use the land that you're on to enact with the food that you eat?
Yeah, I think we're very fortunate in that there's the farm in Hillsboro,
mm-hmm.
that has about 10 to 12 acres under cultivation.
How far away is that from you now?
It's about 20, 25 minutes.
Okay.
So I'll go over there about 3-4 times a week. They've got a dairy cow there that's just milk for the farm, and it's raw milk. So I'm used to drinking that, just like having a half gallon every 2 days or so. But it's very much kind of, you have to eat seasonally based on what's on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of amazed. Our grocery bills are skewed much more towards like some staples like rice and pasta and beer and things like that. That, like, when we can brew our own beer, and we'll do that every now and then, but it's something that it's very much just those basic things, not really, mm-hmm. the flavor that you expect, mm-hmm. for something. So for us, it's been fun. Like, we had potatoes and like we had okra, and so we pickled okra this year, and there's a grapevine we found, so we did scuppernong jam and things like that. That it was, it's really just kind of what's there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's planted much more on a marketing basis of what's seasonal, what do they want to put in the CSA that the farm has, kind of what do we want here. But additionally, just kind of like when I was back on the farm, or even now when I go into the walk-in and see, well, what's left over from last week, and are there collards that are a little wilted that are just as good, right. Things like that that are almost kind of eating the scraps. But you quickly learn that it's amazing how much things just aren't scraps.
Yeah.
That the fact that it's been in a farmer's market for 4 hours and it's kind of wilted, in some instances it'll perk right up, and others it just hasn't really lost the flavor, it's just ugly. So it's based a lot more on, a lot of our diet is based around meat,
mm-hmm.
which has been kind of attacked recently on Mary Bethson, because she actually, there's something on Grist recently, where the Lone Star tick, it's a tick bite that the enzyme actually affects how you process sugars and meats. So it actually makes you allergic to meat.
Wow.
So you can get hives and break out, and she had had horrible reactions in the past. She didn't know what it was. Her other doctor was like, oh, you're fine, just take some antihistamines, you're good. And her other doctor was like, well, do blood tests, and they'd found that might be that. So technically she shouldn't be eating sort of mammalian meat product, whether it's milk, meat, things like that. She can do poultry, eggs, but we've been trying to figure out how to do more chicken or things like that. But everything is kind of, when I ask what do you want for dinner, it usually is based upon what meat do we want to start the meal with, which is very counter to what I tell people at market when they're trying to buy stuff and it's more expensive. And I go, well, honestly, you should probably be making meat a piece of the overall meal as opposed to the centerpiece. If you have the money, awesome, great, but you should probably do like a pork chop, but focus more on, like, if you have the salad beforehand with carrots and radishes, and then you have a sauteed green, or then you have potatoes, like all that, kind of making up the rest, that the meat accents that, or that the meat is such a little part that it's more of a highlight as opposed to just the main part of it that you don't actually fully appreciate when there's so much of. And that's more of a marketing perspective for them. But for us, we just have the access to it that we base a lot of stuff around meat. And again, we're very fortunate. Yeah. Not many people have that luxury.
So how do you and Mary Beth negotiate the cooking while you're here?
I tend to do most of it. And she works at a restaurant in Durham called Piedmont, which the farm co-owns.
Yeah.
And so she waits there. She used to hostess and wait like 4 or 5 nights a week. Now it's 3 nights a week, but usually she's not a morning person. So I'll get up first and, it'll be like oatmeal or muesli or something like that. If somehow we just strike on and we, or it's a store and get, oh, there's cereal, we'll get that. And it's a lot quicker breakfast, but I'm someone who wants to wake up early and like have a while to enjoy it. So it's eggs multiple days a week and I'll cook that. And if we have some bacon or things like that, kind of cook it up. But it's predominantly me cooking, which I think she finds, she feels bad about sometimes, just because she grew up and her mom and dad were divorced, and so her dad never really cooked, and she has hilarious stories about the different, not really a diet in terms of limiting food, just what his focus on food was. So whether it was like a smoothie phase where like you get everything from smoothies, or like he was vegetarian and textured vegetable protein and all kinds of stuff, and her mom, who to this day just doesn't cook a lot, her stepdad does, and he loves making fish, and he's an awesome cook, but her mom just doesn't really cook.
Yeah.
And so for her, that's, she cooks for, she used to cook for herself and take care of, so it's just, since I like doing it, it's a very kind of symbiotic relationship of, she likes eating, she'll help me clean up, but I just, if I do it, I just want to do it.
Yeah.
And one thing I've found, and this is actually almost on a more gendered basis, is women just aren't as comfortable cooking with meat as men. And I don't know if that's just been kind of ingrained over time, but I have a friend who just got, 2 years ago, got married. And they'll come up and visit, and if they'll cook a meal for us, Taylor will go, so you want to do the meat? And Mark's like, yeah, I'll do the meat, no problem. And so it's something where I try to get Mary Beth to cook more meat to get more comfortable with it, and I don't know what it is. I don't know how that's come about, but it's been my experience that it's, even people who come to market, it's a wife asking their husband, like, what kind of meat do you want? What do you want to cook out on the grill? And it's been, it's a very, I think, gender-specific process. And to my understanding, most Americans' minds of a man cooks on a grill. If you're going to grill out, the guy's going to be flipping burgers. Mm-hmm. And so I've been trying to do better about that, learning how to cook more vegetables, things like that. And I'll try to make Mary Beth. I'm like, all right, you're doing the lamb chops tonight. And she goes, you're going to help me. I'm like, yeah. But it's one of those things, the beauty of cooking, and I've noticed it a lot here, is even when you mess up, the fact that you've done it, you still find the good flavor that's there. You still appreciate it to a point that I've burned stuff before. But scrape that a little, and you go, well, that's the chef's crunch. Like, that's, okay. So it's something where cooking-wise, obviously the kitchen is a, 5-foot counter with a slanting ceiling and a tiny stove, which isn't ideal, and I think we're both excited at some point in our lives to have a nicer kitchen, which I think that's something that most people should have, is a super nice kitchen and a nice bedroom, because if you're going to sleep there, if you're going to enjoy yourself. And then, like, the rest of it, if you're in it, whatever. But if you have a nice kitchen, everything kind of just works out from there. There's not a lot of room for us to... Two people is too many cooks in the kitchen sometimes. Yeah. So we'll try to split that up when she's here, and I'll do more meat, and she'll do, like, salads or sweet potatoes, things like that. But it's... I just tend to take it on myself more and try to be creative. And it doesn't usually work.
So now, where did you learn first to cook?
I learned from my mom. She got, I guess when I graduated in 2005 from high school. So it was probably early 2000s when the Food Network kind of really took off, and it really kind of became its own thing of, like, the Alton Browns and Rachel Ray and old school Iron Chef and all that really kind of actually became something you watch, not something you, well, I don't have anything else on, I'll turn that on. Mm-hmm. It kind of became more mainstream. And so I remember Sundays I would run in the morning. It was my long run for the week. So, like, all of our friends would meet up and we'd do, like, you know, from, like, 9 to 14 miles, something like that. And then I'd come home for breakfast, and it was late breakfast on Sundays. Usually about 10, 11 o'clock. We didn't go to church, so it was a very fluid morning. Mm-hmm. But it was eating breakfast, watching, like, 30-minute meals with Rachel Ray and... God, there's almost Sandra Lee, who's kind of a lunatic. She's a, like, suburban housewife who it's semi-homemade, so she's like, here's how you do this cocktail, and it's, but I remember a lot of that, like, the 30-minute meals and kind of learning from that and finding something like, oh, we should do, to this day I remember there's, like, a Polish sausage kind of stir-fry, or kielbasa stir-fry from Rachel Ray that I wanted my mom to do. She's like, okay, well, we can do that. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it was learning from her, like, and making lasagnas or things like that. But even just getting on the farm, there was a guy who was a chef. It was just kind of watching him. And to this day, I'm pretty boring. I mean, honestly, I honestly think everything should start off with at least onions and garlic. Oh, yeah. And so whether it's starting with butter or a decent amount of lard or bacon fat that you've saved from cooking bacon, and then kind of going from there. So if it was me, I'd probably end up making, like, a salad, sautéing some sort of kale, collards, turnip greens, cabbage leaves, broccoli leaves, things like that, and bacon fat, onions, and garlic, kind of having that then with the meat. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that was just learned from him, and just kind of like how he taught me more in terms of how to sell it, and from that I took it back to how I would cook it. So a big thing is, like, we sell sausage and people want something cheaper, so I'm like, well, you actually buy the Polish sausage, you can cut it up, because it's semi-cured, I call it, so it doesn't fall out of the casing when you cut it, and so it's a smoked Polish, so if you want something quick, cook that up, take it out, you've got the fat from that, toss in your onions and garlic, toss the greens on top, kind of saute that down, throw in your meat again, and put it over better rice, and that's quick. So it's kind of a go-to dish, I'll do that, but it really is just kind of process of elimination of what I actually want to do that night, what I have, and then it's... Cookbooks are a lot like maps for me. Like, maps, I could stare at maps all day. I can read cookbooks and get excited about stuff. I don't always follow through with it. We've always talked about, like, we'll pick out one recipe and do that. But it's like cooking Thai food or Indian food or trying to do stuff like that. We'll try to pick out dishes, and it doesn't always work out that with the time. We'll go, all right, we got all this. Let's make it tonight. Well, there's, like, 70 other ingredients. And so it really is just kind of I've become more confident with messing up and just going, well, let's try this. We'll see if it works. Crockpot recipes are great, just in terms of, I guess, the forgotten meats. Mm. So the idea of most people come to a farmer's market and they want pork chops. Pork chop, sausage, tenderloin, baby back ribs in terms of pork, beef, ground beef, steaks. But there's stuff from short ribs, beef shank, pork shank, spare ribs, things like that that are pork roasts, that are great crock pot recipes of a meal for later in the week. On top of that, but something where I really try to sell people on it, it's cheaper per pound. You get so much more flavor, especially with the bone in cuts. It's just, it's easy. It really is just a matter of putting in there, having some sort of base or stock with it, root vegetables, and you just put it on for 10 hours before you go to work, chop it up the night before and go from there. And it's, I think it's trying to sell people. I have an easier time in my mind selling, not that I'm great at it, because I just came with no experience. So I treat most people as having no experience with food, just so they don't have to admit it if it's not true. It's easier for someone to admit, oh, well, I know how to do that, as opposed to saying some in-depth recipe and then going, I have no idea what you're talking about. And so it's a lot easier, I think, to not put someone on the spot and just start from the base and assume they don't know a whole lot about it. Because I remember when I was in school and it was like, oh, there's farmer's markets, great. I was terrified to go to a farmer's market because it was something where if you go up there, you feel like you're on the spot. And it's a much more personal relationship, and it's something where you don't want to offend them if you don't want to buy it. Well, if I want to buy a tomato, do I walk up and, like, feel it? Am I supposed to? Can I just buy it? Do I have to go through this almost buyer's dance of looking at different tomatoes? Am I a schmuck if I pick up the first thing and just, I want that? Which is completely unfounded. It's a ridiculous, irrational notion in my own mind, I've since learned. But the idea that I try to treat it as other people approached it, like me, in an irrational way, trying to make it welcoming to them, and it's okay if you don't want anything, if you just want to look at stuff, if you want to learn about it. And so for me, it's a much easier sell starting from the very simplest thing of using as few ingredients as possible if you start with good ingredients, you don't need a lot of seasoning. And start from there and try to convince people of, if you buy good food, it's not hard to cook. Yeah. I mean, people go, well, how do you do the pork chops? I mean, well, salt and pepper. If you've got some sage, chop that up and put it on there, but salt and pepper. And it takes a while to realize that that's really all you need for most things is salt and pepper. And you can get creative. They can get delicious, but for a simple meal, you really don't need much more than salt and pepper. Salt and pepper and olive oil are probably the things are things that don't come from our farm that we use the most of. Yeah.
That's really cool. So how often do you sell? You're talking about this is how you've learned to present your food at the farm. Do you go to the farmers markets a lot? Or?
Yeah, so the farm does 3 separate farmers markets. And Mary Beth and I do one in Raleigh at the North Hills Shopping Mall, which is a strange setup because it's a mall, but you're promoting local agriculture, so it's this commercialism melded with a local anti-commercialism. But it works, and the management there is great in trying to provide a venue where it's symbiotic of people coming and going to the stores, but it's promoting a family atmosphere, and we really enjoy it. But it's a weekly thing. North Hills is seasonal, so it's from early April to end of November. Last market was this past weekend. And then we'll do a weekly drop-off throughout the fall that people email ahead of time what they want. We'll go there for an hour. They'll swing by, pick it up, and go on their way. So it really is about 4 hours each Saturday at market itself, talking to people and being there and getting people to come by and try to convince them that they want to try the food.
They'll do samples, right?
Yeah.
That's bad. Yeah. That is the seller.
It is. It's amazing how much just cooking some bacon pieces, and it's even better. It's one of the few markets that allows dogs. Oh. So it's amazing how convincing a dog pulling on a leash can be to a person. They just find themselves in a tent and go, oh, smell the bacon. Well, I'm here. Let's talk.
That's great. Well, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your farming experience and getting to working on Coon Rock to now being the farm manager here. Did it start in India? Was that your first?
Yeah, it. I guess it started when I was younger, and just in terms of, like, each year my mom would put out, like, annuals and flowers and things, and I'd help her with that, or we'd have tomatoes or peppers in the garden, and I did a lawn business kind of when I was in high school, so it was taking grass clippings back and leaves and composting and kind of doing that whole process, so it started there, but probably the real first time was in India, kind of working on that farm and really getting my hands dirty and planting stuff, cultivating, doing the vermiculture, things like that.
What was the name of the farm?
It was very poorly named. It was just called The Model Farm.
Okay.
And it was by the Projects Abroad Model Farm in India. It was fun. Like, I really enjoyed it. It was great food. I don't think any of it was organic, probably. But it was, as I think, local as you can get in terms of, like, a third world country and all the ingredients. And then I came back, and the Carolina Farm Stewardship Association here in North Carolina does a great job, in South Carolina as well, of promoting local agriculture. So they host a farm tour, a Piedmont farm tour in the spring. And so my freshman year, I was on a listserv. It was on the Environmental Affairs Committee, because, well, you did a lot in high school. You might as well sign up for stuff in college and do a bunch of random stuff. So just through that, I got an email. I was like, well, I'll volunteer. And so I started working on, not working, but I volunteered at a farm called Dancing Pines in Eflind. So just that one day a year, and I'd sit there and kind of learn from them what they were doing, developed a relationship with them, telling their story to other people. And at that point, like, with each telling, kind of internalizing that of how these are two people, one working for the state, one working for a landscaping business, trying to run a 2-acre farm on their nights and weekends and mornings most times too, just figuring out all that kind of went into it. So each year I just kind of request to be back on their farm. And to this day I still keep in touch with them. They're at the Chapel Hill Farmers Market, and they've been really, really great in terms of kind of letting me know what's out there, kind of encouraging Mary Beth and I and things like that. And then I went to Europe after my sophomore year to study slow food, which was when the foundation, it was much more of a travel study as opposed to international research before they renamed it. And so a friend and I traveled around, and mine was to study local agriculture and the slow food organization and how it was distinguished in Europe compared to the United States. So we went to England, Spain, Italy, and France. And it was a very fortunate experience at that point, because it was very much more go attacker. It was much more each meal was research at that point. So it was really nice. So we were,
how are you doing? I'm Meg.
And this is Mary Beth. This is Meg. And so yeah, we traveled around. I had some friends I'd met in India, so we stayed in England in a small town for a little bit, and like went and did pub trivia at, like, a small town pub, and the shepherd's pie, and it's amazing how much Indian food there is in England, which I think is the best food in England. But then we're in Paris for a while, and it's just kind of crazy how each, I felt bad halfway through until my friend was like, well, honestly, you're eating out all these, like, you are studying. It's not, you're just rationalizing it a very poor way, but it was great. We went to Italy, and Slow Food's international headquarters are in just outside of, not Turin, it's called Bra, Italy, and it's where Carlo Petrini had ended up setting up headquarters after they had gotten their start, I believe in, if I'm not mistaken, 1989, when they were protesting kind of the introduction of a McDonald's by the Spanish Steps in Rome. They were unsuccessful, but it's since melded from this elitist gastronomic experience for gourmands to, I think they have a 3-pillar system, much like the sustainability movement now, of good, clean, and fair. So the idea of it's quality ingredients, it's socially equitable, you're getting it for a good price from the farmers, everyone's gaining, and it's raised in an ecological manner. And that was probably the best part, I would say, is those 4 days I spent in Bra, because it's a very small organization, so mm-hmm. the idea that someone's coming to study them was very much, or it was a small organization, was, oh, yeah, no, come on. And I remember going to, it's like a, I don't even know how to describe it, it was probably about 30 minutes outside the city, and it was, there's like geese just walking around, it was just kind of very low lighting, just kind of table sat outside, and it was the idea, I think the first time it had been instilled in me that good food didn't have to be complex food. Mm. It was a pizza that was pizza crust, good tomato sauce, and like the, I think it was mozzarella di bufala, like the specific type of mozzarella from the region, that was the pizza. Mm. It was a 3-ingredient pizza, and it blew my mind. I mean, I grew up with the idea that I always wanted more on my pizza, that yeah. meat lovers was the way to go, and in essence, it really was just masking individual flavors to make a salty bread meat dish that you didn't have too many complaints about.
Yeah.
So the idea of very simple ingredients, and I loved it. And from, obviously we didn't have a lot of money to spend on good wine, but even just the local alcohol, the breakfast we would do, dinners, things like that, it was a very cool experience. So then we went down to Rome, and then went to Malaga, Spain, to Madrid, we went up to Pamplona for the running of the bulls, which was really cool, and it was just a really fun experience. I don't like traveling that much, and I probably look back on it fonder than I was at the time. I would much rather be in one location to then jump off to different points.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we did that, and then I came back and really didn't want to be in school, just because it was junior year.
Right.
and you want some water?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Thank you. All right.
And so that's when I thought, well, God, I've got to go. I've got to get out. And there was a study abroad program through the Institute for the Environment that was in Bangkok.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I actually got out of school for 7 months. And I went, one of my good friends, it was the strangest thing. We ran together, we were really good friends, and we were going to go on a run one day. I was like, dude, I can't. I've got to go to this meeting. It's for study. Brian goes, no, I can't either. I've got to go to this meeting too. And we show up, we go, oh, same meeting. And he's still at UNC, and he's doing like a marine science PhD program. And so we went to Thailand, and there's like 11 of us. We're in a suburb of Bangkok that used to be the old capital, that 9 menus out of 10 were all in Thai. And so it was a really cool experience, and that for like 7 months, just being away from it. Frustrating as hell at some points, because we never really understood the culture. But that was another thing. We did our capstone project was with rice straw, so the utilization of rice straw. So at the same time, it tied in agriculture for me, which at least made me more interested in it. and then I came back and realized that to finish my degrees, I probably shouldn't drop chemistry, because I'd already spent way too long working towards it. So I had to take an extra semester. And after that, I took my last semester. I was like, I'm going to go in the Peace Corps. I was like, that's what I really want to do. I'll figure out what I'm going to do. Agriculture. I really liked being in India and travel. I'm going to do this. So I applied to the Peace Corps, and I got my, there's different steps. They give you a nomination, and then they give you an invitation, which are not always the same.
Hmm.
And so the nomination was for agriculture. I was going to be an agriculture volunteer leaving in September. Awesome. The internet being what it is, you could look around, and there's a wiki that kind of listed when other people would post their leaving dates. You're like, okay, I might be here, here, or here. So I was like, okay, I'm leaving in September. I don't want to be back home in Kansas. Like, I was dating someone else at the time in Chapel Hill. My friends are in Chapel Hill. I'm going back to Chapel Hill. I want to work in either a butcher shop or on a farm, like something where it doesn't require a long-term commitment, but I want to enjoy what I'm doing. The butcher shop was way too long of a shot, and I started looking around at farms and got in touch with Coon Rock, and it was a perfect kind of set of circumstances of they just had a person leave, they needed someone else quickly, I could still live in Chapel Hill for a little bit until housing was worked out on the farm. So I started working there, and I remember working there. My days were... I really like it, so I'm kind of an old hand now, so I'll tell you, like, when I first started, like, I would wash 60 dozen eggs on Mondays because no one would wash them on Saturday or Sunday, and I had to sit in the transplant room and pick them apart, and we didn't even have a radio in here yet. And so I worked there, and I loved it. Like, I really enjoyed it. The owner, Richard Holcomb, he's a great guy. He's a very laid-back guy, but it's just a really cool experience and a really great... My first, I guess... hands-on introduction to food mm-hmm. production. And so then sometime in mid-July, the Peace Corps said, oh, great, you're going to be an environment volunteer in Peru. And don't decline it because we can't guarantee you'll get another invitation. Oh, what the heck. Once I get there, I can pretty much do what I want. I can do more agricultural stuff. So I left in September for the Peace Corps in Peru and did the 10-week training to be an environmental management volunteer, which was waste management, education, tree planting, and got shipped up to my site in the Central Andes at about 11,000 feet and just didn't enjoy it. Like, it was one of those things I wanted to use the Peace Corps to figure out what I wanted to do with my life, mm-hmm. and I since learned that I did. I wanted to work with agriculture, I just learned it a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. So I was in Peru for about 6.5 months. I was in my site for about, Jackson, for 4 months, and it was something where I realized, I was like, I'm not happy here. Like, I'm not a Marine. I'm not in the green zone. I can go home if I want. I want a farm. Mm-hmm. I want to start working to that. Farming's not really something you hop back into. It requires a lot of money or at least knowledge, and I need to start working on that now because it's genuinely what I love and what I want to do. And if I leave now, I think the community will be better off because I'll get another volunteer in quickly. And so I was honest with myself, which I was really happy about. It was really hard kind of leaving the community it was the first time getting a volunteer since like the 1960s, just because they hadn't really been in communication with the Peace Corps and anything. So I felt bad, but I had to do what was right for me. Mm-hmm. And overall, there's another volunteer there, and I think they're doing fine. I came back, and Mary Beth and I moved back to the farm in April of 2011. And then we've just kind of been there since and working on the farm. And it was one of those things, animals just kind of interested me more from the beginning. So mm-hmm. I kind of carved out my niche and kind of, I think, slowly pushed other people. Kind of like, I slowly just kind of accumulated the workload for animals until Brock does animals. And so then it's just been a lot of reading and just kind of playing around with stuff and seeing what's out there. That's kind of brought us to here when we took over in April, and still to this day, yeah.
Cool. What's the most challenging part about working with animals?
I think it's working with animals. So it's the idea of one thing that I've learned, and Mary Beth's taught me a lot more. I think she understands animals more as another being as opposed to just an animal. So the idea of they get stressed out. There's really cool books by Temple Grandin, who wrote Animals in Translation and Animals Make Us Human. And she's an autistic lady who studied at the University of Chicago or University of Illinois, and she does a lot with animal behavior and, like, for cattle, developing handling areas that don't overly stress them, because the idea that if you stress an animal, it can affect the quality of the meat, can affect their health, just like a human. Well, not the quality of their meat, but their health. And so I think it's the idea of just rather designing things so that the animals are less stressed. And they move easier. So they do with the cows. It's a lot easier to build it so I don't have to move them a lot. It's just like that gate. I just lift up the gate and they all walk through. Or one person can move that. The idea of if you're moving them, you have to create the environment that they want to move from one place to another. So if they're a little hungry, they'll go to more grass. They'll follow kind of some alfalfa pellets. You kind of walk behind them. It's just moving nice and easy so they don't get stirred up and crazy. Like turkeys, if I have to move turkeys, I let them run out of feed that night. The next morning, they're hungry. I take down the fence. They can roam around, pour it back in. So it's just kind of being patient with animals, because despite what I said earlier, they're really not trying to find a way to get out and make you crazy. They're just being animals, and they've got their own personality. So as long as you can stay calm with that, it's really not super stressful. So like with those two pigs being out, it's only an issue because they're getting in the raised beds out there. Not all the raised beds.
I don't have any more carrots and beets left because they've gone to the other
one too. They haven't got to the middle one. I'm going to put pallets over them today.
I just went out and watered them, and I looked really good.
The middle one, they hadn't got to. Right?
Yet.
Well, yeah, then I'll put a palette over it.
We're not going to have any red carrots or any orange, yellow
I'm
carrots.
Sorry. I didn't know they'd go all the way up there. They did once. Okay, it is my fault. But honestly, who knows if we'll actually be here. Maybe they'll move in, like, the end of... It's neither here nor there.
Well, I'm going to mow them over. I'm going to mow whatever.
So, being patient with animals and just kind of letting... treating them in such a way that they enjoy themselves and they're easier to work with and it's a less stressful life. But still knowing full well that there's a very distinct purpose for them. And you can respect an animal and still kill it. Mm-hmm. Despite what PETA may tell you.
That's cool. Just what's one of your like favorite stories from your farming experiences?
There's a lot of them. I mean, there is like the time that they had a new intern, two new interns, visiting, and it was a Sunday morning. We'd already been up and done chores, and I get a call at like 10 a.m. as we're halfway through our breakfast. Richard goes, "Well, there's some pigs out. You come help." So I'd already showered, so I just trudge back out there, and to hear them tell it, they're like, "You just appeared out of nowhere, and we didn't know people lived on the farm, and they're just wandering through mud trying to force pigs back in, and just going back." And that was the Sunday, or
who was that?
When Chuck and Sandy came to visit that first time, and I guess we went out to catch turkeys and move them at night, and we had started, and they have a thing called a chicken getter. Or we call it a chicken getter. It's probably about 3 feet long. It's got a little hook at the end. And so you kind of grab their leg, and they splay their feet out, so it kind of grabs them. And then you kind of walk towards them and pick them up. Well, turkeys don't work as well because they're heavier. So we'd gone out. It was after dinner. I'd showered, and we were going to catch them and put them in the coop so we could move them the next day. First turkey I grab not only pulls the entire thing, I'm left with a handle in my hand. It decides to crap at the same time, and craps in my eye behind my glasses. And I was like, I'm done, Richard. We'll move this at another point. So just kind of the fiascos of, it's just stuff comes up, and you kind of roll with it.
That's great. I was also just thinking, you were talking about kind of the slow food movement that you researched, and then I know Coon Rock does a lot. They've got the local restaurants, and then kind of just the idea of making food accessible and fresh local food accessible for everyone in the community. Where, kind of like, how do you see that playing out through your farming experience?
Yeah. Carla and I have actually differed, I think, on this point. As I've farmed, I've not become more conservative, but I don't see any reason why farmers should go into debt and lose money to feed other people. Mm-hmm. And simply because there's factory farms that can produce cheap meat because they're subsidized by the government and they've had so much funding in the past and they prey on family farms to do their dirty work for them. It genuinely upsets me when people get upset at the price of local food. I think some of it is overpriced. I will agree with that. But where I come down is I've learned that it's expensive to farm. And it kind of frustrates me, the people who will pull up in like a Cadillac Escalade and complain about the price of a T-bone steak. It's like, well, you don't have to eat a T-bone. You can get short ribs for a third of the price. It takes a little more effort to cook. But I think everyone has their choices to make. And farmers shouldn't have to make the choice to lose money just to feed people.
You shouldn't have to be poor.
Yeah.
To feed the world, especially.
And I think it's just about meeting people halfway. I think there's ways that farmers can provide food that's accessible to lower income people, whether it's through a CSA program where other people who can't afford it, you offer the means for them to like donate a CSA to a low income family or something, or you offer subsidized CSAs to other families, or just produce that, like I said before, isn't really bad, it's just not pretty, that you can provide to families that can still eat really well. And it's shocked me. I think we're characterized by a customer base that's upper middle class, tends to be white. At the same time, Indian, given the Indian, or I guess Asian overall, just given the demographic of RTP and kind of the university system and businesses. And it's at the same time, we have customers who you can tell that they buy a lot. And there's like one family who still rents, who's still renting. They've got three kids and they're really genuinely interested in the quality of food for their kids. And it's a big, not sacrifice, but it's a big commitment for them to buy from us.
Mm-hmm.
And I really respect that. I just think that it's all about choices. And a lot of people peg it on farmers for it's your choice on what you price it at. But we sell chickens for $6 a pound. Part of that's driven by a very healthy hawk population that prevents some chickens from making it to market weight. But at the same time, it's just, it's the cost of it. Meat shouldn't be the number one focus mm-hmm. of your meal. So if you get a whole chicken, it's the idea of, well, you cut it up, you can get a couple meals out of it. I mean, between Mary Beth and I, and honestly, for a family of four, you could make a barbecue chicken pizza out of one leg quarter. And then you're left with another leg quarter, wings, boneless, skinless breast. You can cook the whole thing. Then you've got bones to make stock from that if you don't want meat the next time, you can flavor rice or things with it. So it's using more of the meat to get more out of it. But at the same time, we donate some stuff that's doesn't sell as well to, I think it's St. Joe
mm-hmm.
In Chapel Hill.
That's okay.
And they have it's predominantly African-American. It's my understanding people who go there. And so we'll donate stuff that's like pork neck bones or things of that nature. Some of the pork organs that historically the African-American community was forced to use. It's actually some of the healthiest stuff, but it's just in terms of cuts of meat that were available in the South. Organ meat has been viewed as a very low income item. It's still delicious, but even now you'll take stuff, and I've heard of people volunteering there, and there's like people want to come in and they want their like the boxes of expired macaroni or like cereal, things like that, and there's fresh turnips and radishes and greens and stuff that they just don't want, mm-hmm. whether it's they don't know how to cook them or anything. It's and so there's people at UNC who they're like, yeah, we volunteer there at the end. They're like, well, this is gonna go bad. Do you guys want it? And we've taken home like collards and cabbage and stuff that's still perfectly good. Just the people who came in didn't want, mm-hmm. and it was free for them. So it's kind of on the two ends. It's I think more teaching people how to use it as opposed to. I think it's making it accessible in their mind as opposed to accessible in a marketing sense.
Mm.
And people have tons of choices. They can choose to have cable. They can choose to have $90 a month cable. We've chosen to buy a $35 digital antenna. And we're fortunate enough that Maribeth's mom had got us a TV as like a housewarming gift. But we have five channels. We could watch the presidential debates, watch sports, watch local news. But we don't need cable. Like, mm-hmm. it's just not necessary for us. Shoes, clothes, things like that. The things that I think American society values is very skewed.
Mm-hmm.
And the percentages are going to be all off, but it's something where I believe Italians spend the largest portion of their household income on food. It's upwards of 20%. Does that sound right? 20-22%. And Americans are among the lowest in the developed world
mm-hmm.
of how much they're willing to pay for that. Yet, how many people have a smartphone with a data plan or things like that. I mean, it's kind of what's necessary and what Americans are going to value and prioritize in their lives. And I think certain things should be accessible. We heard a guy talk recently at a sustainable agriculture conference, and he's in Arkansas. So he raises chickens, and he'll sell cut-up chickens. He goes, honestly, boneless, skinless chicken breasts, I call crazy white person meat, because that's what most upper-class people, they want their boneless, skinless chicken breast they can put on a Caesar salad. And he goes, and I'll price that accordingly. Like, I'll price it that they can do that so I can almost subsidize the stuff I like, but the stuff that I think is good and makes it more accessible. So leg quarters, like backs and ribs, wings can be priced cheaper in the overall scheme of things. And in essence, you're having a product that's more desired, subsidizing other stuff. And he goes, so I feel like I need to feed a community as well, and it allows me to still make the same money on a chicken but be able to provide stuff at a lower cost.
Hmm.
And I really respect that, and I think that's a good way to market it. I guess he doesn't market it as such, but price it.
Right.
So I think in that sense, having things you can do to make stuff more accessible, whether it's offering, I mean, offering a deal or cheaper cuts of meats or things like that. But the main thing I think is just America's choices and what they prioritize. And at this point, I think farmers kind of have to almost take a stand and go, like, we're not just going to lose money continuously just to feed people. Because at that point, only Purdue, Tyson, Monsanto, Syngenta, Conagra, all those people are going to, they're going to be the ones left. And they're going to be providing crappy food. And at that point, who's to say it's still going to be cheap?
That's it.
Too cute.
But I think that was one of the things, my last semester at UNC, or second to last, I had helped out some with Hope Gardens with, David Barron. I thought it was really cool. And people like Will Allen with, is it Growing Power in Milwaukee? And I think those are cool in terms of urban gardens or trying to provide some sort of a vocational training tied into gardening, which is very important to a often neglected set of society. I think it's a really cool idea. I think it's going to take a lot of work, and it's a good start. And it probably looks very funny to outside people that a Chapel Hill set of students with this idealistic view are going to try to help homeless people by growing organic food. And it probably looks ridiculous at first glance, but I think it's a great idea that is going to fail a number of times before it's gotten right, but that's how everything is. So I really thought it was cool when David Barron started. That was kind of, it was a little late for me because I was graduating, but it's been cool. And hearing Carla talk about it, there have been some things that have been tough to overcome and try to work with, but it's hard enough to get middle-class families to want to rent a plot to grow their own food. And everyone wants to grow the sexy vegetables. They want a tomato plant in their backyard or peppers, but not as many people, that's fine, not as many people want to plant collards or cabbage or things like that. And so it's everything from lower socioeconomic people to middle class to upper class, all kind of making the decision of what they can do, what they can afford, and what they value, I think, in their lives.
I think that ties back a lot to what you were saying at the beginning, too, with kind of valuing the eating of it, of like, is it taste versus ease? Yeah.
Well, it's crazy. At North Hills, there's a Chick-fil-A right behind us, and it's Chick-fil-A probably has more people visit it during the course of the farmer's market as the entire farmer's market as a whole. it's depressing in some respects. They have a bathroom you can use, which is kind of nice. It's got one bonus, but it's amazing the number of people, like the dad that'll walk through with his daughter and son and say hi, maybe take a sample, look around, but they came to go to Chick-fil-A.
I was going to tell you a story yesterday, because I bought these collards, and this woman was like, oh, collards. Oh, I'm going to get those. And she like asked how much they were and everything. She's like, all right, well, I'm going to go to Chick-fil-A, but I'll be back.
Like, you're not. You're not going to be back.
You're not.
One thing I've learned to do is become much more unapologetic about our prices at market, especially where we're located in North Hills, just the socioeconomic base that's there. It doesn't cost us any less to produce food, whether you're rich or poor. And to have even like an old lady who'll say, oh, that's expensive. Well, you've kind of got a 1950s, 1960s mindset of, it's somehow just not gotten all that much more expensive. You've just shifted from good food in the 50s and 60s to slowly more industrialized food that is still cheap today. And I try to explain people, because when I first started, I kind of had an idea of cost, but since then I've run numbers of how much feed goes into hogs, our labor, our electric fencing, how much it costs to process them, the gas it takes, like all those costs, and going, wow, it really is a thin margin, even at $6 a pound for chicken, or like turkeys for Thanksgiving turkeys at $8 a pound. Like it's priced for a reason. I think some stuff should be priced to the market necessarily, to gain more. I mean, if you're the only person selling something, any other thing, Apple has iPhones, or, if Dell comes out with a new computer and they're the first one, they're going to price it higher because they're the only ones with it. it's almost seen, I think, as a sin for a farmer to go, well, I'm the only one who's growing ginger, so why shouldn't I be able to charge a slight premium for it? Why should I be vilified for being able to produce a product that no one else has that I've put the extra effort into, but I should still sell at the same price as Whole Foods or Food Line or something? Like, there should be a base for it, but it's got to be a balance of not selling below your cost. But if you can sell for a premium, if you're the only one selling emu at a farmer's market, which I've never seen around here, I've seen it in Kansas, but not here, charge what the market will take. If there's a high demand for it, why shouldn't you earn more money? I don't think it's greedy. It's just everything else operates that way. It's kind of fresh. It makes you scratch your head that the iPhone 5 comes out and they charge this much. Like, no one else has an iPhone 5. It's a great product. No one's complaining about the price or the iPhone large or iPad mini, whatever it is now. Like, things like that, that they've put the effort into developing it. They've built a brand. Why it can't switch over to agriculture? Everything's been such a commodity that to have a unique, specialized product, why you can't price it to the market and what demand is and what the premium of the product is beyond me. And it's just going to take, I think, a changing of perception on farmers' parts as well as the customers who purchase from them.
That's a lot of really good information to thinking about the economics behind it all.
Yeah. And that's been something for us, figuring out how we're going to be able to own a farm or make a living off a farm, which it's one thing if it's just two people living on a farm and paying for themselves, but then if you want to have kids, if you want your kids to go to college, not all kids are going to get a scholarship, you cross your fingers. how are you going to do that? I mean, it's... Yeah, Jack, you'll go to college. how are you going to do that? Land is so expensive. Land is priced to grow houses right now as opposed to food. How's that going to work? It's kind of daunting. And looking at the economics of it, Coonrock, the owner, Richard, I think brought a very good business sense to it, that there's probably better farmers out there. I think he's one of the best agricultural businessmen, which is a very poor term for it, but for understanding the cost of it, that farming should be financially sustainable as well as, I think, socially sustainable, whether it's kind of rural communities and other places with that flight to urban centers because there's no jobs there.
Mm-hmm.
They've taken away all the labor that's required to harvest grain off of 100 acres because they've got a tractor that can do the job of five people. The idea that it should be kind of socially, financially, environmentally sustainable is something that's lost and I think slowly being regained. But it's going to take just as much on the part of farmers to recognize that within themselves and not undersell themselves at a market. And at the same point, hurt everyone else there. I mean, for someone to bring, well, this really didn't cost me much. I put the seeds in the ground, and I picked them. So $2 for a bunch. It's something you, well, but then you've got insurance. You drove here. You have to stand at the farmer's market. You had to till that land. You had to put up a deer fence. You had to water it. Maybe it cost you more than that.
Mm-hmm.
It took you time to pick 10 bunches. It's like looking at the overall cost. I think sometimes farmers don't realize that, and it can hurt everyone in the process.
You're all over that.
The idea of just because that person... I mean, for example, we were selling cherry tomatoes this year for $5 a pint, organically raised, heirloom varieties, and other people is everywhere from $3 to $5 at the market. People come and go, well, there's $3 over there. I said, yeah, no, they are. From running costs and everything, like, this is the price that we find fair for everything we've put into it. And I'm amazed at how many people still bought from us. And people who, whether they understood that or they're already getting meat, it's easy enough to throw something else on. And it's just, I think, frustrating in the sense that if everyone at that market had charged $5, everyone still would have sold cherry tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's gouging people. I think it's, yeah, some people are more efficient and they could charge less. They could sell more. That's great. I don't think someone's so efficient that they could charge half the price and get the same return.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's unfair to them and it's unfair to other vendors. And it's not malicious on their part. It just is. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they fully understand it. And there's a growing movement of different people. Richard Wiswall, who's up in Maine. Elliot Coleman, Vermont. Elliot Coleman, who's in Maine, of people who are doing much, like, the economics of it and how you run a commercial operation and look at all the labor that goes into it. From tilling, planting, weeding, picking, washing, packing, grading, shipping, selling, like, to look at all those, and if you spend 5 minutes on each of those, then that's an hour, that's $10. I mean, if you're doing a $10 an hour price base, or labor rate, then there's, I think, a movement to get farmers more in tune with, oh, wow, this isn't just a lifestyle. If I want this to be a lifestyle, financially, I have to treat it as such, that I can keep doing. And that's something that is slowly evolving, especially here in the Triangle, from my understanding, in terms of talking to different restaurants and farms and people with the different organizations.
Great. Well, this has been awesome. Do you have any other stories or any last-minute thoughts you'd like to share?
No, not really off the top of my head. Over the course of the day, we could probably tell you of all the times that we had random events and had to do stuff and had to run out and put a tarp over a mama pig because she decided to give birth a week late when it started downpouring and was somehow 32 degrees at the same time. Or when we moved all the cows and realized, well, there's a calf that didn't move, so we've got to chase it down. I have to wrestle it to the ground and put a lead rope on it and try to walk it to the next pasture. There's a lot of random things, but it's something that I truly enjoy what I do, and I know that we're really fortunate to be able to do it. And I wouldn't have a 9-to-5 or anything else, even if I made more money. But it's something, I think people just have to be happy with what they're doing overall, whether it's being happy eating food or happy making what you're making for a living or doing what you're doing with your lifestyle. And so we're, I think, incredibly fortunate in that sense. And we get to take our dog to work. So you can't really argue with that, even if the dog gets into the stinkiest aspects of your work and brings it back to your house and you make him stay in the garage and he looks at you in the most pitiful way.
So he clearly doesn't care.
No, he eats well too. I can't tell you how many pork shank bones he's gone through, beef short rib bones, lamb ribs after a lamb rib chop or something that we'll cook. He does well for himself.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Stop this now.